Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, as I promised last week, we're going to embark upon a series of analyses here on economic theory, which is behind economic policy. Theory is not just a pie in the sky, but it's used to justify economic policies of certain kinds. So if the theories are biased towards capitalists and their interests, well, then the economic analysis involved in policy will be the same. For example, you know, the number one thing you always hear is that if you cut business costs, then that business cost reduction will lead to businesses having more money to invest, and that will create jobs, and therefore in wage income, and therefore consumption, and therefore GDP, right? We hear that all the time. In fact, the $15 trillion in tax cuts since 2001 have all been called jobs acts, creating jobs. Okay, so, you know, that we will see lies in economic theories that were developed centuries ago, well before Keynes wrote his general theory in 1935. As we promised last week, we're going to embark upon, therefore, an analysis of what did Keynes really say? What is Keynes's economics? As opposed to what you hear in the media, in the mainstream, that's taught in almost all the academic departments, in universities and colleges, what's called Keynesian economics. The fundamental point I want to make that Keynes's economics is not Keynesian economics. They're two quite different animals. Of course, they overlap. We'll show how they overlap. But how Keynesian economics is really a form of bastardized Keynes that is composed of pre-Keynes, pre-1935 ideas that Keynes himself railed against, that he spent most of his great work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, 1935, criticizing. Yeah, Keynesian economics is composed to a great extent, not totally, but a great extent, of ideas that Keynes rejected and debunked. So Keynes's economics is not Keynesian. Well, we want to look at this. We want to look at this in some detail here beginning today. And we will continue in this series from time to time, looking at not only how Keynes criticized the prevailing capitalist economy, but how Marx did and how Adam Smith even did. Yeah, okay. And we're going to look at the original works, not third-party biased critiques and misrepresentations of their works. These are three great economists. They're great because they fundamentally changed the direction of economic analysis. Fundamentally, they created a new conceptual framework for analyzing economic conditions. That's why they're great. A new framework. We'll explain the frameworks themselves as we go through this series of looking at these three great economists. Okay, so let's start with Keynes himself, right? Again, the fundamental proposition here, as we begin, is that Keynes's economics is not Keynesian, although there's an overlap. Keynesian economics cherry-picks selective passages from Keynes, especially his 1935 general theory, cherry-picks those ideas that are safe. And it takes those safe elements of Keynes's book and it weds them to pre-Keynesian ideas, which we sometimes call neoclassical economics, up to Keynes, neoclassical. It weds the two together, creates a bastardized version of Keynes and those ideas Keynes himself criticized to create what's called Keynesian economics. It's an unstable amalgam of contradictory views, and it ignores certain major propositions and ideas that Keynes himself proposed that were critical of capitalism. It ignores it. Mainstream Keynesian economics ignores much of Keynes because it is too critical. Okay, so in a way, Keynes is kind of revolutionary. I wouldn't overdo that statement, right? Because as others have pointed out, you know, some of his ideas about the government spending as a way to get out of business cycle crashes, be they recessions or more serious depressions, in a way kind of saved capitalism in the 1930s. Okay, well, actually the 1940s, more spending, more than even social spending in the 30s. But both are examples of government spending. You know, if you look at the U.S. economy in 1929, government spending constituted only 3% of GDP. When you get the New Deal, which is government fiscal spending to raise demand throughout the general populace, what you get is about 15% by 1937 of GDP was government spending. Well, that wasn't really enough to strongly jumpstart the economy and recovery, but it wasn't until World War II that government spending, war and social, constituted 40% of U.S. GDP, 40%. And at one point in early 44, there was so much government spending, most of it on war, it was 70%, 70 of the U.S. economy. It an average of 40 to 50% throughout World War II. Now, keep in mind, you know, China's great boom here from the last couple of decades, government spending investment was also about 40%, 45%. So you have two great historical examples of government spending and government direct investment, U.S. World War II and China in recent decades, that shows that government spending on investment, real investment here, in other words, that produces real goods, that hires real people, that generates real wage income and consumption, that's real investment, not financial asset investment, investing in stocks and bonds and so forth. No, no, I'm not talking about that. But real investment, 30 to 40% appears to ensure robust economic growth that everyone can benefit from. Okay, so that's just an aside here. Let's get back to Keynes himself, right? Why Keynes and his some of his views were really quite critical of capitalism and in a way sort of revolutionary, notwithstanding the fact that government spending saves capitalism, right? The state, the government involvement in the economy, which has continued, you know, from 1929, 3%, 40% during World War II, right? And in post-war U.S. period, around averaging around 20%. It's gone up a little, 22%, whenever there's a crisis here. But, you know, the government has to be involved in the economy, 20, 22% worth, notwithstanding what distribution that is within government spending, war spending, social spending, whatever, but 20, 22%. Capitalism has learned that it can't survive without the deep involvement of the state, the government, in the economy. It will collapse without that. The capitalist state saved the capitalist economy in the 30s and 40s, and it has continued ever since. You know, you might project, what does this mean for going forward? Does it mean it's going to have to play even a greater role? Well, we're beginning to see some evidence of that, you know, with some of the programs here. as a result of this COVID, trillions of dollars of increased spending. Well, we'll see in coming months and years whether the capitalist state has to up its participation, and the U.S. capitalist state will have to provide 25-30%, just like the Chinese state provides 35-40%. Okay, why do I say that Keynes is a revolutionary in some way? Well, because as I began pointing out last week, Keynes concludes his general theory book, which is a critique of why the Depression by 1935 was not put behind after 5 years, in some cases in England and so forth. The Depression hit even earlier, late 20s, why the economy had not recovered sufficiently. So in 1935, he writes the book, and that's a critique of that, which is really a critique also of mainstream economics at the time. Just as Marx critiqued mainstream economics, classical political economy, as a base from which to elaborate his own theories, and just as Adam Smith did the same, critiquing mercantilist prevailing before him economic analysis as a base from which to explain his own contrarian views. All three of these economists do this, right? Keynes did it as well. Critiqued, deep critique of prevailing prior mainstream economic analysis, which was called neoclassical analysis. Okay, but why is Keynes revolutionary? Well, you know, he concludes his book, General Theory, in the last chapter, entitled Concluding Notes on the Social Philosophy Towards Which the General Theory Might Lead, with the following statement at the outset of that final analysis in the final chapter 24. What he says is this. Now listen to this. The outstanding faults of the economic society in which we live are its failure to provide for full employment and its arbitrary and inequitable distribution of wealth and incomes. Two great Achilles heels of the capitalist system. Cannot put everybody to work. And of course, now it's a global system, right? So we got to look at global employment. Cannot put everybody to work. And generates this strong tendency towards income and wealth inequality. Well, doesn't that sound very contemporary, folks? Yes, it does, right? We have a big problem with income and wealth inequality. The worse the wealth inequality gets, the worse the income inequality gets, because it's wealth that throws off income, particularly if you're talking about financial assets. But the problem of generating full employment, don't think of just full-time jobs here in the U.S. as the employment problem. Think of the system now creating more and more part-time and temp jobs. In other words, half of full employment. Not true full employment. This is a strong tendency in capitalism towards what's called contingent labor. In other words, part-time labor, temp labor, and its latest vestiges, gig labor. But as I've said on occasion in the past, the worst is yet to come, because now businesses are moving pell-mell, stumbling over themselves to introduce artificial intelligence in production and in the economy, which even capitalist consulting firms like McKinsey Consultants have predicted in recent years will eliminate 30% of the occupations. These are mostly unskilled occupations. So there's this tremendous tendency of capitalism to remove workers, employment, right? in this case with contingent, part-time, remove their hours of work, and others remove them in half, right, and let them work half jobs, a tendency to do that, and that tendency is going to get worse in this current decade because of artificial intelligence. Technology changes driven by capitalism and introduced by capitalism in their production and distribution systems creates redundant labor more and more. Well, this was something that way back in 1935, Keynes kind of sensed was occurring. It was just the beginning that he saw this. You know, the big move to part-time labor occurred after the 1970s crisis, and the big move to temp labor occurred in the 1990s, and gig labor in the aughts, the late aughts. And now we're going to see the displacement of more and more jobs due to artificial intelligence, AI, in other words, and the restructuring of labor and product markets as a result of AI. And if McKinsey is right, 30% of occupations will either disappear or have their hours of work sharply reduced. All of that represents an unemployment problem. An unemployment problem. And that's just the U.S. Same thing's happening in Europe, in Japan, so forth. At the same time, you got more and more unemployment occurring in the emerging markets world as population rises and they can't absorb the people. That's more traditional unemployment overlaid upon these same trends driven by capitalist technology and revolutionizing the labor markets and the product markets and so forth. So Keynes predicted this. He predicted this. Can't solve the unemployment, doesn't want to solve the unemployment problem, wants to get rid of wage labor and replace it with machines. And, you know, machines can be software machines, just as physical machines, industrial machines. In fact, it's more software now, displacement going on, and that's accelerating. That's accelerating. We're going to look at that in a little more detail here, those trends. I've been writing about that. Changes coming in the labor markets. And by the way, you know, this COVID thing has caused fundamental changes in the labor markets, jobs, in other words, that are only now beginning to become clear. And we're in the early stages of that. Every time there's a crisis, it exacerbates these capitalist trends. And, the two trends that Keynes pointed out clearly were can't solve the unemployment or employment problem, one. Two, tendency towards a growing gap in wealth and income inequality. Well, that sounds pretty revolutionary. But, you know, if any of you had took a class in macroeconomics in college, right, did you hear that at all? I doubt it. I doubt it, because the textbooks that were created for you, that you studied intro and intermediate macroeconomics, right, were not Keynesian. They were this bastardized version of pre-Keynes and Keynes. The safe Keynes stuff, like consumption function and multipliers, to use the jargon, were adapted to pre-Keynesian ideas, which were largely what we call monetarist. In other words, you stimulate the economy, according to Keynesian economics and mainstream economics, you stimulate it by lowering interest rates. Lowering interest rates resulted in a reduction of business costs, and if business costs were reduced, the assumption was that savings, that income savings by businesses would be committed, you know, quickly to investment, and investment would create jobs, employment, and the creation of jobs would create wage income, and wage income would create, in turn, more consumption, and more consumption would, in turn, create an incentive to business to invest even more. That's the pre-Keynesian logic, right, of how to stimulate the economy. In other words, focus on businesses and increase their cash holdings, increase their income, right, first, and then it'll trickle down to everybody else. Yeah, you heard of trickle-down economics. Well, that's fundamentally it. You know, throw the money at businesses, and they'll put it to good use, investing and expanding production of real things, right, that will kickstart the whole process. Yeah, give it to business first, right? Give it to the capitalists first and hope that they will spend it the right way and hope that it will happen pretty quick. They won't sit on the subsidies that you give them. You know, they'll commit it in time zero plus one to investment. You know, they won't hoard it. Big assumption, faulty assumption, right? Another assumption, increase business income, and they'll invest it in real output, real production. I was making things and services, right, that will hire people, not invest it in financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, all that junk, right? Oh, no, they won't. The assumption is they won't distort and divert the savings you give them, government policy, the savings that you use to pump up their disposable income, business disposable income, right? They'll put it all in real production that hires people. They won't divert it to financial asset markets. Well, late 20th century capitalism is doing just that. 21st century capitalism is doing it on steroids, right? All this subsidization of business costs going on is improving the cash flow of businesses, but for most of these corporations, most of it's going into financial assets. It's not going into real investment. And when I say that, I mean globally, because all these financial markets around the world, and they created all new financial markets with all these strange, esoteric financial instruments to speculate in, to divert their money to. And that's what they're doing. And I'm not saying 100%. You know, there still is investment going on in real things, but the balance between financial asset investment and real investment is flowing in favor increasingly year after year to financial asset investment. That's 21st century capitalism. Now, Keynes warned about that. Yeah, we're going to look at chapter 12 of the General Theory, where he warned about the speculators, the financial speculators who were causing instability in the system, in distorting investment instead of investment going into real things that create real jobs and real incomes. It was increasingly going into financial markets. He foresaw that. Chapter 12. Yeah. You never hear anything in your intro and intermediate macro college courses about Chapter 12 of Keynes's General Theory. Well, that's an indictment of the banks and these new shadow banks, emerging financial institutions, which are as powerful now as the commercial banks. I'm talking about investment banks. I'm talking about hedge funds, private equity firms, peer-to-peer lending, boutique banks, asset management companies, and so forth. These are called shadow banks, right? And these are the big culprits. You know, commercial banks are playing the game with them too, because they often loaned these speculators, these hedge funds and so forth, the money to speculate with. Yeah, I mean, J.P. Morgan and Bank of America, they have a big business loaning this money to hedge funds and equity firms and so forth. Yeah, so, you know, it's a big integrated financial system, which is leaning more and more towards financial asset investment. Well, Keynes talks about this in Chapter 12. he warns about this tendency. He called them the rentier capitalists. In other words, these guys who invest and speculate in financial asset prices don't produce anything. They're rentiers. They're parasites on the system, on the capitalist system itself. They're parasites. You know, they undermine it. They cause instability in the whole process. And he warned against them, the rentiers. Now, he made a mistake because in the final chapter, he says, well, these rentiers are going to get their comeuppance here. The government, the capitalist government, is going to see that they're unstable and they're going to get rid of them, or at least, keep them under control while the state itself, capitalist state, expands its involvement, providing real investment, infrastructure, whatever. Yeah, well, he was wrong. He was wrong. Keynes was wrong there. That's not what happened. The rentier capitalists did not go away, aren't going away. They're getting stronger and stronger in capitalism. That's why we have more and more financial instability events occurring. Because they always overextend themselves. The speculators always overextend themselves, right? They throw too much money into bitcoins, and when the price crashes, they're in trouble and they lose their shirt. And because the real commercial banks loan them the money, the crisis spills over to the traditional banking system as well. And when that happens, as we saw in 2008 and 2009, the banks stop lending to all other kinds of businesses because they're in trouble. And then the non-bank businesses are in trouble and they lay people off massively, i.e., that's what we see when we have these financial-driven crises going on. Okay, so chapter 12, pretty revolutionary here as far as Keynes is concerned, right? And today, in other words, this stuff is not just esoteric theory. This stuff has relevance to policy today and economic conditions today. We got too much wealth inequality, income inequality. We have a chronic problem with job markets and employment, creating employment, and it's going to get worse with AI, right? We have a problem here with these financial institutions destabilizing their very capitalist system itself. Pretty revolutionary, right? And here's another revolutionary element in Keynes. I've been talking about chapter 24, income inequality and employment, and chapter 12, financial speculation and instability. But Keynes starts out his book criticizing mainstream economics prevailing at the time. He takes them on. He takes them on in a fundamental way, just as Marx did with prevailing political economy, and just as Smith did with prevailing economy, the mercantilist theory. All these great economists, use this critique of their prevailing paradigm economic predecessors as a launching pad for coming up with their own explanations of what's going on. And to do that, all these three economists, right, create new concepts, new propositions, new statements about how economics works that are really revolutionary in the sense that they're totally new and contradictory to the old. So, all of them become great economists because they see something that the prevailing economic discipline could not see, because their concepts were biased or did not want to see, did not want to deal with, And revolutionary economists like these three come along and say, well, we see it, and you can't understand it because the concepts you use do not address the new anomaly that we see, right? You can't explain it because your conceptual framework is not conducive to understanding it. Adam Smith critiques mercantilism because he argues mercantilism, you can't understand economic growth, right? You see wealth as just the accumulation of gold. That's not wealth. Wealth is the making of things, right? The more things you make, the more money you can create. And if there's not enough gold money, well, we'll just make paper money because it's irrelevant. Money is just the consequences, the creation of money, of the creation of things, the making of things. The more things you make, the more money you can create to enable the buying and selling of it. You see? That was Adam Smith, and really criticized the mercantilists, which saw wealth as just the accumulation of gold. And then you get Marx. Marx comes along and he says, well, classical economics, what you're saying is that the system always self-corrects itself. Supply creates its own demand. Savings is equal to investment, right? And therefore, there are no depressions, no business cycles. Well, in reality, they were throughout the whole 19th century, tremendous depressions and recessions all the time. But economists before Marx didn't want to look at that. They didn't want to deal with that topic, right? But Marx did. And Marx uses the framework of classical economics. He uses their framework, but he adds to it. He changes it, right? He uses them as a fulcrum to develop his own new concepts and his own new ideas that show that capitalism is very unstable and that capitalism will lead to a breakdown. Inherent within it, are problems of instability that lead to massive unemployment and so forth. Well, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves talking about Marxist theory. We'll get to that. But Keynes does the same thing, you see? Keynes does the same thing. What he does is say, okay, prevailing neoclassical economics cannot explain the Great Depression. You guys don't understand it because your conceptual framework, your set of concepts and their relationships, just don't understand what's going on. You got to create new concepts. You got to create new kinds of logical analysis of how economic variables, key variables, interact with each other. And here I'm doing this. And he creates, Keynes creates, a new conceptual framework built upon the old, maintaining the old in part, but rejecting a lot of the old and substituting his new ideas for the old. All these great economists built upon the past, rejected parts of the past, but also took parts of the past with them, adding their new ideas on top of it and integrated with them, all of them. You know, revolutions of any kind are a consolidation of some of the past with the new. It's never a rejection totally of all the past, whether in ideas or whether in the real world, right? It's an extension of some of the past integrated, synthesized with the new. Okay, so what did Keynes criticize in prevailing neoclassical economics before him at the time? Well, he starts out the book, you know, we've talked about the last chapter here, and then chapter 12, but now let's go back to the very beginning. The first part of his book, the very first part of his book, you know, several chapters, is really a critique of prevailing views in economics, right? What we call book one, and even book two, but book one, where he talks about the postulates, in other words, the proposition main ideas of classical, neoclassical economics. You know, what are the main tenets, the main ideas and concepts of classical economics? He called it classical. Today we call this period neoclassical. So he starts out criticizing these main ideas as the basis for then proposing his own contrarian ideas in subsequent chapters. You know, the general theory is broken down into what's called books, and within the books are chapters. Book one, you know, the chapters have to do with criticizing the main points of classical, neoclassical economics. Book two, he starts setting out some of his own ideas, concepts, right? Particularly concepts that have to do with investment, savings and investment. And then, you know, in book three, some new revolutionary ideas about consumption. But then the rest of the book, you know, after these three chapters on consumption, which have to do with new concepts like propensity to consume and multipliers and so forth, which we'll get to, the rest of the book, right, from chapter 11 on, is about investment. And to what extent money determines and interest rates determine investment, and to what extent other factors determine investment. You see, the title of the book is A General Theory of Employment, interest rates, and money. You know, critics of Keynes say, oh, well, he's only interested in fiscal policy, you know, government spending. No, Keynes was a monetarist. In fact, before he wrote The General Theory, his great tome, two-volume tome, was a theory of money. Neoclassical economists before him did not understand money and interest rates, did not understand it well enough. So Keynes is a monetarist as much as a fiscal advocate, fiscal spending advocate, right? And that's often lost. Okay, so he's going to talk about what role interest rates play in money supply, and money demand play in stimulating investment. And his views would be quite different than predecessor views. But, you know, to get back to the first book, first three chapters, where he attacks, criticizes his predecessors, neoclassical predecessors. In that section, what we get is a very fundamental critique of what were prevailing economic theory at the time on how to stimulate the economy and get out of the depression. Right? Fundamental critique. And what he critiques is really still around today. Mainstream economics did not agree with Keynes's critique of neoclassical views on how you get out of a depression or a recession. Today, they don't agree even today. In other words, that's part of this bastardized version of Keynes, where you take something from Keynes, take his consumption theory analysis, right? But you keep what Keynes critiqued in investment, what determines recovery from investment. You keep that. Keynesian economics is a bastardized version, once again, of pre-Keynes and Keynes. That's why it's so fundamentally different than Keynes's economics. Okay, well, a digression here. How do I know this? Well, for 6 years now, I've been teaching a course for seniors at St. Mary's College, just reading the basic works, chapter by chapter, page by page, of Keynes's General Theory, Marx's Volume 1 of Capital, and Smith's Wealth of Nations, basic book, right? After 6 years, I kind of know what's being said in these three books, rereading it every year for 6 years in a row, right? And most economists, by the way, who teach macroeconomics in colleges have never read Keynes or Marx or even Smith. They've never read it. What they push in their classes are what's in the textbook, which is this bastardized version. And they don't even know it's a bastardized version. They never read the original works. I can attest to that. I know my colleagues, right? I don't like to read second and third analyses of original works. Go read the originals, because especially controversial revolutionary writers, right? You're going to get all kind of biases and misrepresentations of their work for political reasons, particularly in the capitalist system, right? The ideology is going to distort it to turn you away from it. Read the originals. Well, I read the originals the last 6 years every year. Okay. So back to this fundamental critique that Keynes makes, that he makes of the predecessors and their views on how you get out of the crisis. What did they say? Well, what Keynes does is use this mainstream, at the time, economist, Cecil Pigou, as a straw man, right? He attacks Cecil Pigou, probably the most noted economist in Britain at the time. And Pigou writes this book, even before Keynes, about the employment and depression, right? So that book becomes the touchstone here for Keynes's criticism of Pigou. Now, what did Pigou say? This is very important. What Pigou said was that, okay, if you're in a depression, you have a collapse of business production, right? When you have a collapse of production, you got people who aren't working. They're laid off, or they got wage cuts going on. What Pigou said was that the way to generate a recovery was to the government to help business increase its disposable income. And how do you do that? Well, you reduce business costs, right? The solution was to reduce business costs, which would mean businesses had more disposable income because their costs are reduced. And therefore, if they had more disposable income, they would invest it, expand production, and by expanding production, they'd have to hire more people. That would create more wage income, and that wage income would stimulate more consumption. In other words, investment and consumption were one and the same thing. There weren't different forces determining investment or determining consumption. Now, Keynes will come along and say, no, they are, to a great extent, investment and consumption, autonomous from each other. That you got to understand a set of determinants of consumption that aren't necessarily the same set of determinants for investment. Neoclassical economics, conflated the two, investment and consumption, and argued that investment was the determinant of consumption. So what Pigou argued was that the way to get out of a depression, to stimulate investment, right, was to lower business costs, and he argued especially to lower wages, the major business cost, especially at that time and under industrial capitalism, right? That therefore the problem of a lack of recovery from a depression, this is the early 1930s now, was that workers would not reduce their wages. Right? If they only would reduce their wages, then business would have more income and more investment would follow, etc. So in effect, the victims of the Depression, the workers, were the cause of a lack of recovery from it. You know, the victims were the fault. Well, that's always ideology. You know, blame the victor, the victims for the problem. Right? Of course, that still goes on today, doesn't it? We'll draw the parallels with policy today shortly. Okay, so reduce wages. And you can argue the same thing, or reduce interest rates, which would be reducing borrowing costs to business, or even reduce business taxes has the same effect, right? Reduce the costs, generate more disposable income, and the assumption is for these pre-Keynesian neoclassicals, in almost timeless period here, they would reinvest it, and that would generate the recovery. Well, Keynes says, oh, you got it all ass backwards, guys, you know, really. Because if you reduce wages, what you're doing is reducing workers' disposable wage income, and then workers won't have the money to spend to buy the products that you say business is going to increase in terms of their output, right? They're going to, in business, going to invest and produce more products and so forth. Well, you're doing just the bottom, just the opposite of what you should be doing. You shouldn't be cutting wages. You should be getting the government to increase workers' disposable income so they could buy your products. That would then stimulate your investment demand. In other words, Pigou and neoclassicals said investment in business income determines employment levels and wages, whereas Keynes says, no, ask backwards, guys. It's wages and income that determines investment. He reverses the causality relationship between investment and wages and income. Okay? He reverses it. That's pretty revolutionary. But don't we see this today? In fact, we've seen it consistently, right? The way to stimulate the economy is to reduce business taxes, right? Yeah. Or to lower interest rates. The lower interest rates will stimulate investment, right? The cost of borrowing is lower. Therefore, business will borrow more and invest and spend it. Well, Keynes says, oh, that's ass backwards too, fellas, because it's not lower interest rates that stimulate investment. It's investment that drives interest rates. Again, the causality is reversed. That's all pretty revolutionary, you know, when you think about it, or at least revolutionary at the level of economic ideas. He's saying that your analyses are incorrect, you know, and your concepts are incorrect. Well, you know, it's not the cost of investment that's important. What determines investment? Well, Keynes will spend chapter on chapter here explaining the determinants of investment, right? And it's not cost. It's not the cost of whatever it is you're replacing or building. It's not the borrowing costs, right? It's not the wage costs, right? It's what he calls expectations of the rate of return, i.e., a concept that's really profitability. Expectations of profitability is what drives investment, business investment. In other words, whether business thinks they can make a profit is really the determinant of whether they invest or not. And if they think that the profit is there, if they expect it, if they are so optimistic they expect it, it does not matter what the interest rate is. The interest rate will rise as the demand for investment increases by business. And business won't care. They'll pay higher interest rates as long as, you know, the opportunity is greater than the cost. And you can see this in the real world, right? It's not the interest rates that drove Apple to create the product line it did, you know, Apple Computer. No, no. And it didn't matter how much Apple had to pay to borrow money from banks to get going. No, because they saw the expectation of profitability even greater. Here's an example on a small business scale, what I'm talking about. Let's say that, you know, you're a small business person. You have a flower delivery business, service delivery business. You know, you go out to the nurseries at 3 a.m. and your drivers pick up flowers and then they distribute them to hotels and restaurants and, you know, grocery stores and so forth every day, fresh flowers. You know, and let's say, you know, you've got three drivers who do this, three trucks and three drivers, right? You know, you're a small business person. You wear many hats. You got to make sort of expectations of what the market will be and what the demand will be and the economic conditions. You know, you're the accountant. You're the marketing manager. You're the one of the main salespeople, maybe the main salespeople. Now, you got a pretty good computer in your head. Big companies hire, you know, hundreds of people to do all this marketing and accounting and finance stuff. But small business guys, they got to do it all in their head. If they can't do it in their head, then they go under. But let's say you're Mr. Flower Man here, and you're thinking of expanding over into the you know, next city or couple cities here. And that means you're going to have to hire more drivers. Okay, that's going to cost me $40,000 a year. Okay, and that means you're going to have to get more trucks, right? Three more trucks. And that means you're going to have to pay gas and insurance and so forth, right, for all of that. And, you know, that's a certain cost. Well, you're not going to do that unless you think, well, three more guys, you know, in a new area that there's no competitors, I think I can sell X number of additional flowers. You got to be able to figure out, yeah, I can sell more flowers and get more revenue than it's going to cost me for these trucks. Now, what if you're in a recession and Toyota says, hey, we're going to give you, come buy our trucks, you know, no interest rate charge on our trucks, zero interest. You know, just take the trucks and maybe we'll even give you a cash incentive to buy three new trucks. All right? Well, that's a pretty good deal. We've lowered the interest rate to nothing, right, for the new investment in the new trucks. Right? But wait a minute. I still gotta pay wages. I still gotta pay insurance and gas. Right? Can I sell more flowers in the expanded area I'm going, you know, to cover that cost? If I think I'm, you know, it's close to break even, I'm not going to take that risk. I got to be able to think that I'm going to make a lot more revenue with the fixed cost. You see, it has nothing to do with interest rates. That decision, you know, has nothing to do with interest rates. It may not even have anything to do with the fact, well, I can hire guys at $5,000 a year less because it's a recession now, you know. That may not be sufficient because in a recession, no one's going to buy flowers, not no one, but most of the people aren't going to buy flowers anymore. You know, that's something they can do without. You know, that's the calculation in the real world of business that's made. And you can see from that it's not the costs that determine investment. It's the expectations of profitability, or what Keynes called the rate of return, that determines investment. Quite contrary to what Pigou and the neoclassical said, oh, just lower interest rate, lower wages, and that would, you know, generate the investment. Because investment is the key driver of capitalism, you see. Investment, or what Marx and Smith would call capital accumulation. They meant investment, real investment. That's the driver. And it's usually the collapse of real investment that throws the economy into a deep crisis and recessions and depressions. It's the collapse of that investment, right? Well, is the way getting out of the crisis to pump more money into those sources, i.e. businesses, that cause the recession by reducing investment, right? Do you give them more money to stimulate the investment?
Well,
or do you say, no, no, we got to give money to those who will buy the things that business creates in order to convince business to increase investment? You see, what's the causal logical relationship here between the two? Well, neoclassical pre-Keynes said that it's the former. You know, give money and it will trickle down and that will cause the recovery, right? Where Keynes says, no, no, trickle down doesn't work, right? Giving money to those that caused the crisis will not work. What you got, because they'll sit on it. They'll hoard it. They'll take it. They'll take the tax cut, right? They'll take the low interest rate. They may even borrow the money and then sit on it. Or today, they borrow the money at zero interest and then they throw it into the stock markets, you see. That's what's happening now, even more than in Keynes this time. So, you know, don't we see this today? Doesn't mainstream economics continue to argue, oh, lower interest rate? Even Paul Krugman, oh, we got to keep interest rates low, right? And therefore, we'll stimulate borrowing and investment. Oh, Federal Reserve, you know, pump $120 billion a month into the banks to keep interest rates low, which is happening. You know, $4 trillion last year and $120 billion every month continuing. Free money, throwing it at the banks, throwing it at business to borrow, right? Are they borrowing? No. The cost of money is zero. Is it generating a significant acceleration in real investment? No. Not happening. If you cut wages, is that going to stimulate investment? No. You know, I mean, their business is cutting wages. That's why workers aren't going back. They're cutting it by recutting hours of work, getting people to come back on a partial basis. Well, people aren't coming back. They're not going to do well. Is that wage cut generating a boom? Well, some investment, but no, it's not. Subsidizing business incomes, either through massive tax cuts, which, by the way, we continue to do always, or, you know, the Congress continues to do, massive business tax cuts, right? Or interest rate reductions to zero, or wage cuts and fewer hours of work. None of that stimulates investment. Okay, so, you know, it's pretty clear that policy today is a reflection of pre-Keynesian ideas, pre-Keynes. Oh, you got guys like Robert Reich and Sanders and some of the others who are trying to propose Keynes-like income stimulus, and there's a little of that having occurred with the COVID relief bill, but not enough, right? But the predominant view is, oh, subsidize businesses, and they will invest, and that will generate recovery, right? Well, that's pre-Keynes. That's not Keynesian. That's not Keynes's. That's Keynesian. That's pre-Keynes. Yes. And that's where we are today. The policies are still largely pre-Keynesian. Pre-Keynes, rather, I should say. They're Keynesian, but they're pre-Keynes. Right? Okay. So we'll continue a little bit more with Keynes next week, and then we're going to go on to do the same analysis for Marx and Smith. And you'd be surprised what they really said.